It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
And as I stood there, and the blood was starting to pool around my feet, I realized that he had been right. It was David Byrne. It was not David Lynch. But obviously by that point, there wasn't anything to do.
It's an honest mistake, really. I'm sure that kind of thing happens all the time.
It does just to me, so. Clearly.
Yeah.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat Podcast, the only podcast in the world that won't let us stop.
Nope.
I'm Evil Tony.
And I'm Evil William.
We don't know what episode number this is. That's your job.
Yep.
Or something. It's probably four. Let's say four. This is episode four.
Episode four.
Yes. Once again, something has gone wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we're sucked into this process. For those of you just joining us, there is a hat. It is magical in that it has its own email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Folks, somewhere, someplace, write emails to that address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com, with little notes, comments, questions, topics, things like that. The hat, all on its own, magically transmogrifies those emails and little note cards with the information written on them that manifest physically within the hat itself. Because of Earth's polluted atmosphere, Ultraman can only retain his form, his giant form, for 3 Earth minutes. Time is running out. Sorry, that was unrelated. Those other guys, usually do this, but we do it when they're busy. Draw the note cards out of the hat at random, read them on the air, talk about them till they're bored, and do that for about an hour, and that's the whole show. And we are the B team.
Yep.
And we don't like it, and we've tried to sue, but weirdly, we don't have lawyers in the Evil Universe.
Nope.
I know that's very counterintuitive to you people in the other one, but yeah, no lawyers here.
I mean, the only reason we know what lawyers are is because, you know, we have our interaction with the other universe through this podcast.
And Perry Mason. We still get Perry Mason here.
Well, I forgot about Perry Mason.
Yeah, he's a lawyer. That's what it is. Wow. So it'd be cool to have more of those.
But that's right. We have Perry Mason, and for us, it was just a fantasy program.
Yeah.
You know, like wizards and aliens and things like that. Lawyers. It's like we just made them up. We thought. But no, in your universe, they're all over the place, I guess.
I think I was talking about, but you know the story, the Neil Gaiman story, that we all were reading out loud, and I was wanted to turn it to writer. Trish a while back got me a comic book of it.
Mm.
Like, they actually did an artistic thing of it. And I read it recently again. It was interesting. It's certain things come across better visually, certain things don't come across as well visually. Which I have dealt with before. There's an audio play by Neil Gaiman that I love called Murder Mysteries that I listen to all the time. And then I found out that my friends made a graphic novel version of it, and I read that, and I'm like, this is cool. It also loses certain things, though, that you can get across through audio and through sound effects and stuff like that. No, that just made me think of it, because at the end of that, he decides to write fantasy.
Yes.
Yeah, in the same sort of way.
Yep.
That's the thing that stuck with me when I used to watch Ultraman, is every time, every episode, his little chest light would start blinking, and the narrator would say, because of Earth's polluted atmosphere, Ultraman can only retain his gigantic form for 3 Earth minutes. Time is running out. And then he would kick the monster in the face or whatever, and it'd be fine.
Ultraman.
Ultraman is one of the earlier than like Voltron and Power Rangers and stuff, giant robot things. Mm-hmm. And the iteration I saw, which would have been probably in the mid-90s or whatever, I want to say was like made in Australia or something, but it was like the 20th version of Ultraman. I mean, Ultraman started, I think, in the 50s or 60s or something over in Japan. And yeah, that's all it is, this giant robot from space, like, who, this guy, that's his secret identity, there's this guy, and so when bad things happen, he turns into this giant robot from space, and Haikibas his way through them. And
but he has to go back to being a little dude. Yes,
because of Earth's polluted atmosphere.
3 minutes, that's it.
I don't know that that was true from the beginning, because back in the 50s, I don't think we talked about Earth's polluted atmosphere. Oh, so
maybe not.
But yeah, you got. That's the only way you could build tension, because it's like, he's going to win. He always wins.
But he's got 3 minutes!
Yeah, so maybe he's, time is running out. So you got stuff?
Nope. Oh,
me neither.
I guess I draw from the hat.
I guess that's the plan. How are you guys doing at home, listening? Fine, don't answer.
Yeah. That was rude.
There's a sketch I watched recently, and it's actually reoccurring. And it's pretty brilliant. So, it's a live-action sketch, and it's on a farm, sort of, and there's a horse. And there's an actor. And the actor shows up, and basically he shows up saying, "I'm sorry we haven't been getting along. I really want this to work out better, so let's try again." And it turns out he's trying to sort of do an act with the horse in which they sing together. And so they sing together, and the horse doesn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets, basically a guy went, there's an easier way to explain this.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a scene where somebody goes to do collaborative work with somebody else, and it's actually a recurring bit they've done in this show, or goes to discuss the relationship or various things like that, and the other person doesn't even say anything or acknowledge their presence, and so they get really mad, and they're like, "Why is it always me?" And like, they break stuff and they yell and they call them names and stuff, and then later they'll be like, "I'm sorry," but it constantly happens. Like, at one point they make them a cake and the person doesn't care about this, except the person in this case is a real horse who doesn't, because it's a horse, so doesn't even care, and but basically the person reacts as though all of the horse's responses are not because it's a horse, but because it's just ignoring him or giving it the cold shoulder. And it's hilarious to see. Why do I always have to meet you and you can't meet me halfway? Say something! Alright, so, what'd you draw?
Coffee. Discuss what emotions you wrestle with on a daily basis.
Wrestling. I mean, let's stop now and be like, you know, arguably tons and dozens of different ones.
Sure.
Whatever, but let's set that aside and focus on the non-outliers. How does your scatter graph, you know, show trends? Well, obviously, I mean, insofar as you call it an emotion, I struggle with anxiety. I mean, I'm medicated for that exact thing. And to a lesser degree, there's depressive aspects. I think I struggle a lot with various versions of self-loathing, and I think I'm not alone in this. Like, thinking, "Oh, I suck, and whatever I'm doing, oh, I'm not good enough for this," or, "Oh, I'm not treating my friend or my loved one well enough," or, "Oh, I'm not doing a good enough job at whatever I'm doing," and that kind of thing. But interestingly, I've been actively working against that lately and working on trying to, like, accept myself and appreciate the good things about myself and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's turning me a little narcissistic.
Why do you say that?
Because I'm discovering lately that I give way less of a damn about what's going on with other people and what other people want to tell me. And I still listen and smile, but I'm like, oh my God, this is so boring. Why can't they be more entertaining like I am? And then I'm like, wait, what? When did that happen? Because that's the thing, I don't make any claim that the things I have to say inherently are more interesting. I just think I say them in more interesting ways. And I want other people to do this too. But I've just very recently been noticing this. I'm like, I think I'm getting too self-obsessed in my attempts to be more accepting of myself.
Mm.
And so I also wrestle with that side of it. I wrestle with self-loathing and arrogance, depending on the day.
Like a pendulum swing, huh?
And of course, in the modern political climate and everything, I wrestle with just baffled rage all the time. Anything, so many things in a day, easily 20 things on any day, part of my brain is like, that's so awful, why would that even happen, or why would they even do that, or what could those people be thinking, or whatever. That happens constantly, and I want to get really mad, and both, I wrestle with trying not to just, like, freak the fuck out,
because
mm-hmm. that would be rude, especially if it's a live person, and then, like, you punch them in the face, and that's no good. But also, you know, if I'm sitting at work and I just start losing my shit over a political story, like, that's not helpful. But also, my whole, you know, trying to see both. I mean, there are some people that I'm like, yeah, they're being assholes. But there's other times where I'm like, come on. This is bad, but they, from their perspective, it makes sense that they would think this. Or in some cases, it's even like, it's still a valid argument. Mm. Just because you disagree with it so strongly doesn't mean. And so I wrestle with that a lot, especially in recent years.
Yeah.
A lot. How about you? I've now said a shit ton about this. You should say some things.
Yeah.
Wrestling with what to say.
Depression. Like, I'll wake up. It seems like in recent months.
There's a cat up by my face, so if things sound weird, that's why.
Maybe recent years, I'll wake up in the morning. Usually, I probably had some bad dream or something that I don't remember. But I'll just be really, just all kinds of just negative thoughts. Yeah, self-loathing is probably the biggest thing. But, or anger about things going on in the world. Or both, you know. And so, and some days it can really take me a while to sort of get into a frame of mind where I can, like, just even get up and function, right? And then as the day progresses, you know, that those feelings try to come back all the time. But that's pretty much my daily struggle, is depression that mostly comes from self-loathing, but also does come from being angry about things that are going on in the world.
Perhaps you should attempt to be more accepting and appreciative of yourself.
Well,
it's really fun. It turns you narcissistic.
I mean, that's part of it. You know, that's part of coping, is to, you know, sort of speak to that voice and say, look, you're being ridiculous. You know, I'm not Hitler, for God's sakes. I'm just an ordinary person with ordinary problems that I don't particularly like, and that I really dislike, as a matter of fact. But, you know, what's narcissistic, it seems to me, is to build oneself up in their mind like a terrible person, like, you know what I'm saying, like, yeah, more terrible than normal. I mean, that's a kind of narcissism too. So, you know, that's usually how I get past that.
I don't remember, somewhere in my pagan teachings this came up, and it's a really useful thing to start from, which is that no person is more important than any other person.
That's right.
And no person is less important than any other person.
That's right. That's right.
And then, as long as you operate on that principle, how you feel about yourself, good or bad, doesn't necessarily impact. Because, like, you can think you are hot shit. But as long as you go through the day and interact with people and act in a manner consistent with believing that you are no more or less important than anyone else, it's not really a problem.
Right, that's right. That's right.
So that can be helpful. Obviously, if you think that you're lowlier than a worm, that can be hard on your system. But again, as long as you are acting in a way that shows that you don't think you're less important or more important than anyone else, I think that mitigates a lot of it. I think that's just a good attitude to have.
Well, that,
full disclosure, I don't know that I do that with any success. There's a lot of things I know about how I would like to live that I don't think that's how I'm living.
Right. And also, it feels really hypocritical for me to treat myself worse than I would treat somebody else.
Yeah.
It just, there's a part of me that wants to think I have a justification for that, but I don't.
Well,
so it's just ridiculous.
You can correct me if this doesn't apply to you, but marriage has altered that in that my partner will do those things, will beat up on herself or whatever, and not only I'm like, oh no, honey, that's not, like, I'm angry at her for being hard on her, as though they were two separate people.
Like mean to herself. Yeah.
Exactly. Like, I hate the person that's being mean because I love the person that's being the victim.
Yeah.
But over time, I can adapt that to my own awareness.
Right,
and so when I'm being hard on myself, I'll be like, come on, that's not fair. And it would make Trish very unhappy if you were, she loves you, so she would be mad at you for being mean to you.
Right.
I think that has helped me a lot in that kind of thing.
Sure,
I can stop myself and be like, imagine your wife was doing this. You'd be mad at her.
I do think that helps. I mean, sometimes when I think about my mom, and I think about, well, what would she want me to be doing, or what would she want me to be, and that was true before she passed. Sometimes thinking about my family what they would say if I could talk to them, and knowing how they would feel about it. But I suppose since she died, there seems to be more urgency for me to honor her, I guess. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think so.
Like, I think before she passed, it was too easy for me to, well, but she's my mom, so of course she's going to blah, blah, blah.
Oh, yeah.
But now it's different, because now it's, but, this is how mom stays alive in my life, is for me to respect her wishes, what she would have wanted for me. So it's a slightly different, it's harder to dismiss, right, than it was when she was alive.
I feel like we're also seriously poking holes in the tried and true philosophy that in order to really love others, you have to be able to love yourself. I think we're saying sometimes the opposite can be the case.
Well, that seems...
Being able to love someone else and then put yourself in those shoes can help you love yourself.
Sure, or that the whole linear aspect is probably a misunderstanding. There's a feedback loop there.
Exactly, yes.
So it all kind of comes together, really.
And especially if you really, like you had, I know enough to say this about your marriage and my marriage, I don't know for other people, but you and I deeply love our wives. We also deeply admire and respect our wives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so there is, and I don't know, maybe this is cheating in some ways, but I'm like, Trish wouldn't marry an asshole.
Well, yeah,
like,
I mean,
if I really believe that she's as smart and wonderful as she is, and I do believe that, then I have to think that she would not be dumb enough to marry somebody as big a jerk as I think I am.
You've got to give her some credit.
Exactly.
I feel that's, that comes up in my mind.
And again, also because I tend to use that argument on her when she's too hard on herself. I'm like, if you were the kind of person you're claiming you are, I would not be with you. But you're not that kind of person.
Yeah, that's come up with me and my wife too, where, she'll be very critical of herself. This is something that people tend to do. I've done it. Everyone's done it, I'm sure, at one point or another. When you're critical of oneself, but the way you're responding to it is by sort of projecting that onto the other person, they're being critical of you.
Well, and that's, yeah.
And so then you explain, well, if I really felt that way, I wouldn't even be standing here talking to you about this. I would just be gone.
See, I thought you were going to go the route where I get really frustrated with people doing things I don't like. but it tends to be like, oh, you know the thing. It's like, why does that one coworker just really piss me off? And almost every single time when I really think about it and process it, it's because they strongly display a negative trait that I feel I have.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I've realized that
and
too.
That, and I
myself about people.
Lately, I'm really working on. I'm not even working on like. Trying, I mean, there, you know, I want to get in better shape and stuff like that, but it's not even about improvement, and that's the thing I'm realizing now. It's not about get your act together and do the things you want. I'm working on being happy with me, which does not mean that I don't try and improve myself and think about what are my motivations for things, what do I really want. I still do that stuff, but I'm working really hard to find myself an okay person and find all aspects of myself okay. And it's very hard and it's very slow going.
Well, you kind
of. But it's very rewarding. I feel better just in general.
Well, I think you need that to build a sort of a foundation. I mean, you were talking about the things that you examine in yourself that you want to change. Well, you're kind of building something. And there's the analogy of a house is very apt, I think. There's got to be a foundation. If you don't have a foundation of basic liking yourself or accepting yourself, you're not going to be able to build those things on top of it. So
my sister-in-law used to have a team building exercise company. Like, they would go out and do team building things. And one of the exercises that they do is you draw these circles and they represent the different aspects of you. And so there's one in the middle that's just the general you as a person.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's you as a spouse, you as a, you know, parent,
mm-hmm.
you as a whatever your job is, all these things. And you were supposed to rate yourself 1 to 10 in each of them.
Okay.
And pretty much the entire point of the exercise was that the one that's just you as a person should always be 10. Because you are, like, you're the best you possible
right.
because you're the only you.
Yeah, that's right, that's right.
And even if things change, like, the you right now is the best you that we've got. And that nobody fails at being a human.
Or at being.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting.
And I'm trying to do that. And I mean, I am also aware that if I was like, you know what? I'm good. How I am right now, I'm set. This is it from now on. I'm going to put it on cruise control.
Mm-hmm.
Would be weird and boring and a little scary. Like, there's always should be stuff to work on, and, you know, boy howdy do I have stuff to work on. But that's cool. I mean, it's cool that I want to be better, and it's cool that I try and be better, and it's cool that I do new things, and it doesn't mean that I'm bad until I complete them.
Right, that's right. Yep, that's right.
And I mean, I've talked a lot about the whole fat acceptance thing, which is a big one that I'm focusing on lately. Which is terrifying because it's the same through the looking glass thing. I see fat shaming everywhere now.
Yeah.
It's. I mean, I saw it before, but it's the subtle ones that, like, the thing, and somebody's like, but what about, and you're like, oh, shit, I never even thought about that. Just the weird, and just, like, people at work, somebody who was like, you know, I went to we were talking about if we went to the gym when, because we kind of are accountable to each other. And we're like, did you go? Oh, you should have gone. Oh, I went. Good job. And they said, like, I went and I did a whole bunch of exercise on such and such a day because I was feeling really chubby because I had eaten a lot earlier. And I'm just like,
That's interesting.
I was like, okay, first off, and we've said this, we've talked about this before, but what you ate earlier and you exercise, those two don't cancel out. They aren't directly related at all.
Yeah.
But second, I finally had to say, I said, I'm going to need you to stop saying things like that around me. Even if it's about yourself. I mean, I'm not... it's the normative aspect. Again, saying I'm fat is... I am fat. That's a real thing. It's where we say that that's a problem or that's bad and that I start having... And this was clearly one of those situations.
Right.
And I was like, genuinely, it was weird to get to that point, but I was like, I'm going to need you to stop referring to yourself that way when you're around me.
Yeah.
And they were surprisingly fine with that. But it was a new one for me. I hadn't run into that before. And just, yeah, just stuff that, I mean, the fat shaming's so normal in our society that so much of it you don't think about, even if you're trying to keep track. It's just there.
Well, I mean, I think there's evidence to suggest there's a lot of pressure. I mean, certainly on, certainly on people of size, I guess you could say, if that's one way to describe them. But everybody has, I mean, people are criticized for being too skinny. People are criticized for being too this, too that. I mean, the ideals for what the human body is supposed to be for both men and women is so narrow.
And so monolithic.
And also with gender, like, yep. You know, where...
not monolithic in that case, but it's bilithic.
Yeah, well,
but that's the part that bugs me, is the idea that in any case, in any of these circumstances, we have one or perhaps a small number of discrete options, and those are for everyone.
Right.
It doesn't work. Every single book you have read about how to get healthy, unless it was a complete scam, was a book about somebody who got healthy doing certain things and then wrote a book assuming that if everybody else does those things,
yeah,
they
right.
will have the same impacts. And that is demonstrably untrue.
That's right. That's right. But, I mean, we've got standards. We've got standards for, you know, whether or not a person should wear makeup. We've got standards for how much hair a person should have. We've on their heads and on other parts of their body. It's just ridiculous.
Just tonight.
We've got standards of what people can wear.
Just tonight was watching, before podcast, episode of Seinfeld from 1998. I saw it in the thing, so I know it's that specific year. And it's an episode where Elaine meets this guy, and he's very cagey about what he does and where he lives, and she thinks he might be cheating or something like that. Whereas Jerry's got this idea that maybe he's a superhero, and he's hiding his identity this way. And he's like, he could be the Green Lantern. And she's like, which was that one again? It's like, green suit, power ring. And she says, I don't care for jewelry on men. And the laugh track happened. And, like, that was 98, which doesn't seem that long ago. I mean, I was an adult at that point. But I'm like, fuck you, Elaine. Like, fuck you hard. Yeah. And at the time, that not only was it not a big deal, that wasn't even a particularly heavy joke. Like, that was a very tossed-off joke until Kramer stumbled through the door or whatever. But now I'm just like, fuck the hell off. You're going around, don't care for jewelry on men. I'm like, okay, first of all, there's about four definitions in there we have to work out. And then second of all, why do we care what you care? Like, I was really mad at her.
Well, but I mean, a lot of people don't think about the psychological impact on a person who for whatever reason, however they came to want this or to really have a desire for this, they want less body hair, they want a body that looks nice in a dress, and they want to... they want to wear makeup every day, but they're a man. Okay, because think about that for a second. Why shouldn't any human being be able just to do any of that stuff if they want to?
But
they can't. No. And think about what that does to a person psychologically. And that's just one example. If you really think about it, there are a lot of subtle examples of all these rules that we have to follow in relation to our bodies and how we adorn them that can really mess a person up psychologically without them even realizing that's happening.
And we are making breakthroughs in this all the time. But attached to this is this idea, and this has been bugging me lately. I brought this up the other day to somebody, that this is new. And this is the thing. There's a large number of people out there who tend to get mad at all these changes because they're like, in the old days, we didn't have this problem. I hear people saying, like, did you, growing up, did you have guns in your house? And the other old person says, yeah, I did. Did anybody shoot anybody with them? No. And there's this idea that, like, back in the day, we had things a certain way and it was fine. And this is a message to those people. Yes, it was fine for you, and it was fine for the majority of people. But these people that you're seeing now that are wanting all this stuff that you think is weird were there before. They just suffered in silence and had terrible things happen
to
them,
right.
Or had to live in denial their whole life. The the demographics have not changed. The people who, the guys who want to go out in dresses were always there.
Yep.
They just knew they would die if they let anybody knew. And they were convinced that it was the worst thing in the world that they wanted to do that. But this is not new. Gay didn't get invented in the 60s.
No.
None of this shit, none of the crazy shit that is going on is new. You just know about it now. And now that people know about it, we need to fucking deal with it.
But the thing is, too, though, that a lot of people are scared of these changes, but I don't get a sense that they're really scared of these things. They just can't change. I mean, that what they're really scared of, you know, like, even if they deny that global warming is happening, they hear about it all the time.
Yeah.
And I think it affects how they see their future. You know, there's certain political and economic realities that can't be denied, but they feel powerless to do anything about those things, so they have to have a scapegoat, they have to have someone to blame.
If you believe in it, then you get really fucking scared.
Yeah, so, you know, I know people who, you know, I'm almost 50, and I've known these people for a long time, and I remember when I was in my teens and 20s, what kind of people they were in terms of being open-minded about race and interracial marriage and gay people and whatever, and now suddenly they're not so open-minded. Well, and whenever I hear them say things that aren't very open-minded, I know they don't believe that. I just know it. It seems like they're, but I also know that there are certain real things out there that are threatening and scary that they're really scared about, but they don't talk about those things. They talk about this group of people or that group of people.
But there's still a component of that real thing. Let's say, hypothetically, you're a middle-aged white man in America. Try and put yourself in that mindset. All right?
Yeah.
All right. Let's say that.
That's really hard.
I know. And you're heterosexual, and you go to school, you learn things, you grow up, you become a man. And you're a man that likes women, and takes care of women, holds doors open, pays for the meal when you're out. And, you know, you feel cool about doing that for women because you like women and you want to do nice things for women. And, you know, sometimes you get them to do sex things for you, and that's cool. And eventually you find one and you marry, and that's wonderful because you love that one and you take care of her and you provide for her and she keeps the house clean and has your kids and stuff. And you get all this cool shit for just keeping your head down doing your job, and that's wonderful, and that's how it's supposed to be, and you are a traditional good guy. You don't hit your wife, you don't drink to excess, you don't cheat on her, you provide for her, that kind of thing. And that's great. And now people are saying, yeah, but there's a lot of unfairness in that. What if she wants to earn? What if she wants her own spouse to take care of things? What if she wants that spouse to be a woman? What about the black guy who's in the same situation, but nobody will hire him because he's black, or the police shoot him and he's dead, and things like this? And these aren't your fault, but now it's not okay for you to be that kind of person and get those things, and then that's good. Now it's not all right for you to take what seemed like the appropriate sort of share of life's bounty for putting in the work and being the kind of guy you are. They say that's too, you're getting too much now.
Who's saying that?
Society. Liberals.
Okay.
Society. And here's the thing. It's true. White guys get way too much of the stuff. All of the stuff. Social acceptance, money, everything. And it's not equitable. And it's not your fault, heterosexual white guy.
But for it to be fixed, you're going to have to give some things
exactly,
up.
Exactly. Shit has to change. And you're not being punished, but a lot of it will result in less cool shit, less privilege for you. And that's, if you really think about that, that's, and especially when you're like, if you'd been born a generation before, not a problem. And in fact, a generation from now, things may be in a much wonderful situation, so you wouldn't expect that.
Sure.
But you're the guy, and it happens every generation, because different things happen.
Sure.
But you're the guy, in this generation, we've decided that we have to have affirmative action. In this generation, we've decided that we really don't like rape, you know, things like that. And you're the guy who has to live with that and deal with that and suffer those changes through no fault of your own.
Right, but now, but do you think just the feeling that something that you had is going to be or needs to be taken away from you, is that enough? Or does the person have to feel like, because I think there's a presumption that just that reality where, you know, you get this size of a piece of the pie, and it's probably going to have to be a smaller piece of the pie, and that's enough to make a person upset. Because I'm not sure that's true. I think the person also has to have a sense that they can't spare that amount of the piece of
pie. It's not necessarily that you can't spare it. It's that I said all this, but you've only got their word for it. So you're going to have a smaller piece of the pie unless those people are wrong. Okay. A certain percentage of people are going to go, then clearly those people are wrong. No,
yeah, that's right. That's
right. Or at least convince themselves. I'm not saying that they're trying to game the system. I'm saying that their brain is like, well, shit. Wait, you know what? They must be confused. This is fine. Well, and like I said, the big one, that this is normal. Because when we hear stories from the past, we don't hear about the fucked up shit that was happening.
Sure.
We hear about our families that had their nice, simple upbringing that's exactly the way we want to be now.
But I just think that there's a little extra element there where it's not just that something's going, that they perceive something's going to have to be taken away from them. It's also the perception that they can't afford for it to be taken away for whatever reason.
Well, and yeah, that frequently comes into everybody thinks they're middle class and that kind of thing. Like,
because
nobody thinks they have more than other people.
Well, right. I mean, there are a lot of people who, you know, they give to charities. They see themselves as having more than some other people have, and they're very happy and willing to give a portion of that up. To the degree that if they learn about privilege, for example, and that, oh gosh, you know, there's something else that I get that I didn't even realize I was getting, that I could probably get a little bit less of on behalf of somebody else.
Yeah.
So to that kind of person, learning about privilege isn't really going to, that they're already in a way of thinking that they know already they get more than other people get. They're already used to giving some of what they get away to help those people.
Yeah.
So it seems like the people that get upset are the ones who feel like they don't have enough to give back.
Well, there is a component also, I think, that, well, like I said, everybody thinks they're middle class. Everybody thinks they're normal, or at least wants to believe that. And I shouldn't even say everybody, because that's the whole thing, is there are tons of successful white heterosexual men out there that are completely understanding of this.
Yeah.
And you're an example that are completely understanding and are willing to change. But there are ones that think, like, I have a person's allotment of this stuff. And when you say, no, you've actually got way more than a lot of people.
They just don't believe it.
You don't want to believe it, because then you feel like, oh, am I being selfish? And then also you're like, I have to give it up and stuff, because most people aren't like, wow, I have such abundance. I mean, people like to say that when they give speeches and stuff. But most people are like, no. They're either like, I've got an okay life, or they're like, you know, oh, I could always use more. I'm you know.
So you think these people are like, are operating from a perspective of scarcity?
Yes.
Yeah.
To a degree. And there's also a lot of intangible ones, because there are plenty of poor as fuck heterosexual white men out there that are like, what are you talking about, privilege?
Yeah, right.
But the problem is because there are other components, and it's so hard to see them, because you know what? I don't relate to anyone who has been pulled over more or less by the cops than I have, because I've never been there with them.
Yeah.
Like, maybe if I had a friend who was black and I frequently hung out with them and they always drove, and I was really short, so a cop, like, I might start to notice, wow, cops bug you a lot more than they do me. But it doesn't come up for me. So now I know. I mean, I choose to believe people that say that. And you can even find seriously conservative black people, and you ask them, like, you know, do the cop, and they're like, well, yeah, that's a thing. But So there's also the component of having to take someone else's word for it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you don't see it. Because that's always the amazing thing, is when somebody's like, I thought feminism was bunk. I thought white privilege was bullshit. I thought trans people and gays were deviant, crazy people. And then, usually, I developed a personal relationship with somebody who fits in these categories. And or sometimes it's someone explained slash showed it to me in a way that suddenly my eyes was open and they get woke, and then suddenly they're like, holy shit, of course that's what we should do. And that's an amazing thing to see. In a lot of cases, it's just that their eyes just haven't been opened.
Yeah, but I don't think the default of ignorance is to assume that a person's lying, or I think they're told, like, if they don't know a gay person, or if they don't understand privilege, or if they don't know any people of color who have dealt with things, I don't think they have any reason just to assume when they hear about these things that it's a lie. Someone's telling them it's a lie.
Of course, yeah. Nobody, like, didn't hear about gay people until they were 12, and then a person showed up and they're like, I'm gay, and they're like, what does that mean? And they explained it, and they were like, oh my god, fuck you! No, somebody earlier said,
yeah, someone
Jesus
planted.
Does not like it sure, when guys are
sure,
with guys.
Sure, sure. I wonder what... Does anyone ever think about what motive people would have to lie about that? I mean, like with being gay, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the argument is, well, the motivation is they have these sinful urges, and we all have sinful urges, and we all want to indulge sinful urges. We just know we shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
So that's their justification for lying about homosexuality, is they don't want to change their sinful urges. But but this is a strange notion when you think about it. Like, there's this thing inside you that no one could locate. It's not a scientific principle that makes you want to do things that you shouldn't do, and it's part of the human condition for you.
It's part of God's plan
for you to just resist that thing.
To test you, yeah. No, that I mean that I buy as the religious argument. If that's your faith, then. But then I have a whole bunch of other issues, and the big one obviously is people go, well, the Bible says homosexuality is bad, and you're like, okay, how about wearing mixed fibers? How about selling your daughter into slavery and stuff? And the argument I see, especially when it comes to sex things, like different sexual orientations and stuff, is the real answer. And I don't think people consciously are aware of this, but to a lot of heterosexual, especially males out there, the idea of two guys engaging in romantic or sexual activity grosses them out. And it's so much more easy if you can, instead of saying, you know what, that's just the thing that grosses me out. I know it's my problem, not yours. It's so much easier if you can say, well, it grosses you out because it's evil. It's so much easier to be like, that notion of revulsion that you have to the idea of two dudes kissing that makes you go, isn't you just having dumb tastes or being too... It's because it's evil, and you know that, and you can tell. It's just wrong.
Well, here's another thing that I don't hear very many people talk about, and that is, religious beliefs are fine. I don't have a problem with them, obviously, but there comes a point where your religious claims are testable. And when that happens, sorry, but science is a thing. The tests that people can run, and or the experiments that people can do, or the studies that people can do are real. And for example, if your religion says that the earth is a disc, your religion is wrong in that regard. That's not someone being critical of your religion or trying to trample your First Amendment rights. Any worldview that makes testable claims are subject to those tests. And claims about the gender binary, like that's some kind of thing that's in everybody, and that God put in there, something put in there, that's a testable claim that does not hold up to scrutiny. The idea that homosexuality and bisexuality and asexuality, these aren't really things.
And they don't show up in any other animals except humans.
None of that stuff, that does not hold up to scientific scrutiny. There's just a lot of claims that religion can make that are not actually religious claims.
Yeah.
They're scientific claims. And therefore, we shouldn't, no human being ought to be obliged to believe them, you know, in any circumstance, and it's not a challenge of someone's culture. I think I feel the same way about claims where culture says, well, it's a valid part of our culture that you have to respect, where we're going to have a tyrannical attitude toward this group or this person, or we're going to abuse or harm this group or person. Nope, sorry. that's a thing you can observe as a bad thing. You cannot hide behind your religion or your culture in that instance. Not at all.
I see a way where you can, and there are some people that are like this. If I genuinely believe, part of my faith is that God put me here to kill all the fags, then society's going to have some problems with that. But I feel like that's a pretty clear thing. Like, God wants me to do that. But very few people believe that. Very few. What they believe is that God disapproves of homosexuality. I keep using homosexuality, but this can apply to all sorts of things.
Yeah, all kinds of things.
But that God's gonna fucking handle it. That when the gay dude dies, he's gonna go to hell. And it's not your goddamn problem.
Well,
and
from a Christian perspective anyway.
But and
mostly.
And from a proselytizing perspective, I also understand, as much as it annoys the shit out of me, that maybe you want to try and save them. And I even get those kind of things. I hate it. And I also think even if the people who are trying to do that are doing it badly. I'm like, if I genuinely was trying to convince somebody not to be gay anymore, I could do it way better than homophobic fundamentalists could do. But outside of that, it's certainly not in your purview to say, I'm not going to let them do these things, I'm not going to let them do these things, they can't. No! Look to your own shit, and then they'll get thrown in eternal fire afterwards. You know, God has certainly not called you to make their lives harder, or to try and alter their lives in ways that have no impact on you.
Which is why when you run into a person like that, usually there's a lot more going on than just whatever they think they read in the Bible.
Yeah. And it's I was raised with this one, and it's very strongly, your right to swing your arm ends at the other person's nose. That is a very simple ethical rule to follow. That it matters to other people when it's impacting other people, but when it's something somebody does themselves and it doesn't impact you, it's none of your business.
Nope.
And even if you think it's evil, God will handle that. He's gonna let all the fags burn later. He's good like that. You know God. You like him. He's good at what he does. One might argue, I think you might argue, hypothetical fundamentalist here, he's better at what he does than you are, even.
Yep.
So maybe leave it to him. And just sit around if you want. I mean, what you really should be doing is sitting around feeling sad and pitying them. But if you want, and I know you do, sit around and feel smug about how, yeah, now it's fun going off having your little parades and shit, but later you'll suffer. And do that, and leave us alone. Yeah. And then you can laugh in heaven at us in hell. It'll be great.
Well,
and I might apologize. I don't know. I feel like if that whole version of God and heaven and hell turns out to be real, I'm going to have a lot of shit to say to God first. But
well, in my experience, hate does not just come from ignorance. There's something else. There's some other thing.
I think it's frequently fear and insecurity.
Yeah. And I mean, the person will spew ignorant stuff as a justification, but
all right, no, but let's hit me with this then. Because in recent times, I find myself feeling hate. And I have always worked very hard not to. But there are people in this world that I really hate. There are people in this world that I wish ill to now. I never used to have that, but I really do. And most of the time, I want them to learn and grow and change and not be hateful anymore. But sometimes I just want them to die. And sometimes I have violent fantasies about doing terrible things to them that won't solve anything except that they'll be taken care of and gone. Now, I know this is not healthy, and this is not what I believe, and I do try and work against it. That's not the point of this. What I'm saying then is, so, where does my hate come from in that instance? And I'm not trying to question your motive. I'm saying let's follow this experiment out.
Let me guess.
Okay. Yeah. Because I mean, yeah. Obviously, we won't know the answer. But
I'm going to guess that for you, the people who are the subjects of this emotion are people who either have harmed someone in a significant way or are yet harming someone in a significant way.
Frequently, abuse of power and blatant large-scale deception or exploitation is a lot of it.
Sure, but it's not abstract. I mean, people are suffering from it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and you find this unforgivable. While you're hating them, I mean.
Yeah, I don't know. I just, one that really stuck with me lately. Oh my god, I can't believe I'm talking about this here. I have had fantasies of individuals who I have been so angry at that what I wanted to do was, it was basically a torture fantasy, but it was very specifically about also teaching them what they have been wrong about.
Yeah, punishing.
And but making them learn a lesson, but not for their redemption, because it's still they die at the end.
Right.
And I don't believe in that, and normally I don't have that when I see people suffering. Obviously, I want them not to suffer anymore, but I want the people to realize the suffering like that they're causing and change for the better, and that kind of thing. And so this kind of stuff is really quite recent. And I know we're dancing around some obvious stuff here legal reasons. And it's broader than that. That's not the only the instance that everybody knows I'm talking about is not the only instance I'm talking about.
But what I'm saying is there's harm being caused in your perception.
Definitely. Yeah.
And
I wouldn't get mad at people if there was no harm involved.
And this is making you angry.
Yes.
And it's a very typical human reaction, especially when the anger is coming from clear and measurable harm.
Yeah.
For you to want to stop that behavior by any means necessary, but also...
What's the distinction between anger and hate? There clearly is one. They are not the same thing. But I'd be hard-pressed to explain exactly what the difference is.
Well, the difference is... It's about the relationship between anger and hate. There's a... I think anyway, the way I understand it is there's an emotional process where anger is a prerequisite condition for hate, but it doesn't necessarily lead to hate.
See, that's interesting, because I agree, you can have anger without hate. I think you can have hate without anger.
I don't know.
I think you can have a very calm, accepting. Obviously, you can have that on the surface and spoil it inside. But maybe not. I don't know. I've never really thought about it. Because, in general, I try and avoid hate. I feel that it is unhelpful. Yes, and I do believe that in almost every situation, nobody's 100% on the right
sure,
and 100%
but
on the wrong.
But think about how you avoid it. Okay, just what you said there.
I try and broaden my perspective of a given situation. If I feel hate kicking in, I try and think, what does this mean in the bigger sense? Where are the things that are making me mad coming from? Where am I coming from?
Yeah. In other words, you address your anger.
Yes, I would say that is true.
So that's how you short circuit. You take care of the anger, that takes care of the hate. But
it doesn't seem as revelatory for me to say hate. If we're saying hate comes from something. To say hate comes from anger.
But it doesn't. No, it doesn't come from anger. No.
Okay, so then where does it come from?
Okay.
Where does my hate come from?
Look, it's like any process. The steps in the process, each step creates the conditions where the something can emerge, but it doesn't cause that thing to emerge. Hate is still something different.
Okay.
But it's like, it's kind of like, you know, you put on the coat. Why do you put on the coat? Because it's cold outside. It's cold outside, so you put on the coat. You didn't have to put on the coat. The cold, in a way, didn't make you put on the coat. You decided to put on the coat because you wanted to be more comfortable and you didn't want to be shivering or you didn't want to feel cold. You see what I'm saying? So, and actually, that's a perfect example, because what you want to do is you want to do something to relieve the anger. You need it. It builds pressure. It makes you uncomfortable. It creates stress. Hate is like a pressure valve. When you can hate something, you can vent that anger
out.
It's
not your problem. It's their problem.
That's right.
Well, and it ties to issues of frustration and issues of impotence.
That's right.
Which,
you're powerless.
Yeah, which is interesting to me. Because if I apply that to the things I hate, that also makes sense. That they're also having, they're coming from a place of a sense of frustration,
yep,
powerlessness, which is sometimes super ironic, but still, an impotence.
And you want to reclaim that power.
Yeah.
And one way you can do that is by harming the person, forcing the person to feel the empathy that they so clearly don't feel. These relieve the
That's
symptoms
what it's
of
always
anger.
About. It's never about eliminating the source of it's forcing empathy on them.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. Because that's what you're angry about.
Yeah.
You're angry that they don't seem to get it.
Yeah.
So you're gonna make them get it.
I'm trying to empathize with them and they're clearly very angry, so no way that's not. Wow, this episode super went off the rails. That's impressive. No, I think it was good. I'm just saying, us in the evil universe, this is not a typical episode for us. For starters, we usually do more than one question. But, well, it was interesting, worthwhile, if you're one of those touchy-feely, good universe jerks. So, I guess if you're listening now, listen again next week, because that's how the show works.
Yeah.
But otherwise, if you hate the show, think about how maybe you really hate the show because you're impotent.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.